Welcome to this class on the English language. I have never been here to WFTI before, and so I feel a little bit new. I don't know many of you. You probably don't know me, so I'll introduce myself a bit. I'm Verlin Garber from Hartsville, Alabama. I've taught school for 7 years and plan to be teaching again this year on a part-time basis, 2 days a week. I've taught upper graders, so that's kind of my comfort zone. That's what I'm familiar with. A lot of the material, the things we want to talk about this week, have to do with the English language, its history, like I explained before, and the grammar, especially looking at the grammar more on an upper grade level. Happy to have my wife and family here with me today. It's my wife, Larissa, in the back, and we've got three little girls, too. You've got the handout there. You notice it has a lot of white space. I tend to be a fan of that. You can make it your own that way. Fill in whatever you want to as far as notes and things. Today, I hope to look at some reasons why we teach English grammar, why it's important to teach it. Had an interesting conversation with an attendee here, and he said that he thinks he's going to go to the science class instead of the English class because science is definitely the most important subject. I said, you're absolutely wrong. English is, and I hope by the time we're done with these classes, you'll agree about the importance of English. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be your favorite subject, although maybe we can change that too. I have learned... when I started teaching, English was probably my least or one of my least favorite subjects. Come on in. There's a handout there on the chair in the back. You're welcome to. And I don't think it's my favorite today, but it's definitely a lot higher on the list than it used to be. And then I want to look at some of the history, the development of the English language. I find it very fascinating. It helps us understand why the language is the way it is when we understand how it got to be the way that it was. And then once we're through with that, which will probably flow into tomorrow on the history a good deal, then I want to talk about what you want to talk about. Did you come to this class because you struggle teaching grammar? If so, then drop me a note or talk to me, flag me down somewhere, and tell me what you'd like to talk about. What shall we talk about? You want to talk about retained objects? You want to talk about moods of verbs? You want to talk... You name it. If I don't get feedback... I'm not sure. We might dismiss early. I've got some things. I do want to then, after we talk about that, give some tips on how we can teach English grammar, how we can help our students to experience the joy of grammar. I have found it to be a very exciting study, and you might think the joy of grammar is a little odd, but I was assigned a workshop on that 1 year, which is kind of the foundation for this as well, and since then that term, the joy of grammar, has kind of stuck with me, and I think it is joyful. And you notice there on your handout, on Roman numeral 2.E, the joy of grammar / making it... This is not a trick question. But how do you say that word?
Live.
Live. Or live. Well, it makes a difference. If you make English grammar live, you make it interesting, you make it exciting, you involve your students in it, and hopefully we can do that this week. If you make it live... you become a living example of English grammar, and you express it to your students. So, just a little plug there, if you're going to teach English, you should probably have correct grammar. I come from the South, where our grammar ain't all that great, so if you hear me slip up, that's just the way it is. But I do welcome your feedback as well. If you want to correct my grammar, go right ahead. A few objectives for this workshop. First of all, I like to help us together realize the beauty and the order that's found in English grammar. It's not a bunch of contradictory rules that don't make sense. There's beauty and order in English grammar. We want to realize that. Secondly, and this has to do with the concepts of grammar, we'd like to master the foundational concepts of English grammar in order to teach them simply. You've probably heard it said that it's impossible to teach well from the edge of the cliff of your knowledge. Well, let's expand our knowledge of English grammar this week. We can teach better, we can teach more simply, hopefully reach our students where they're at and help them to understand it. The third one goes along with that, gather strategy tips for helping my students grasp the concepts. I'll just give you a sneak preview of one of them. I found that my upper grade students could not remember four things. One of them was that you will not have a direct object unless you have an action verb. And we'll look at those four things later, and maybe you've got more. So be thinking about your own strategy tips. What are some things you've found that help to make concepts stick for your students that otherwise they struggle with? And a fourth one is maybe a bit tongue-in-cheek. To make this class unnecessary by ensuring that future teachers will understand grammar thoroughly. Because I see this vicious cycle going on. We have students in school who don't like grammar. How many of you did not like English when you were in school? And that includes me, okay? And you graduated with maybe less than a stellar grasp of it. Well, I had a good teacher. We had a pretty good handle on it. Well, guess what happens in many cases? You leave the classroom at the end of 8 years or 10 or whatever, and you don't pick up English books again, language arts, whatever, until you're asked to teach. And now you've got to teach it, and you don't really understand it any better than you did the day you graduated, and so you struggle to teach it, and so your students struggle to learn it, and they don't like it. You see what I'm saying? That vicious cycle. Let's stop that cycle. What is grammar? Basically, it's the rules about how to speak and write in a language. There is a certain correct way to speak and write in English. The good news is that the vast majority of English grammar you know automatically because you spoke it growing up. Grammar also includes the study of a language, how it works, and everything about it. It's a study of sentence structure, and it's a set of rules and examples to illustrate how the language should be used. Point five on your handout there, why teach English grammar? Too many of us say, why do I have to teach English grammar? There are so many negative viewpoints out there about that, and I've already talked about one of them, the thing of not understanding it, and therefore it doesn't make sense, and I don't get it, and I don't like it. That in itself is one reason it has to be taught. If English grammar were easy, you wouldn't have to teach it. It'd be automatic. Maybe some of us teach grammar simply because it's part of the curriculum and you've got to do it. Well, that's better than not teaching it. But I would like to destroy that myth. English grammar is not hard to understand. How many of you know a second language? I'm not talking about a spoken language only like Dutch. I'm talking something... Now, if you can speak and write German, yeah. But something like Spanish or German or any second language. Okay. Did you speak it growing up or did you study it? You studied it. And which language?
Spanish.
Okay. Well, I'm there with you as well. I have studied Spanish. I'm not really fluent, but I can get along. And I do know Dutch. So I'm not trying to diminish it as a language, but I think you'll see here in a little bit why I differentiate. The more you study other languages, the more you will come to find that English grammar is one of the easier grammars out there. Now, I'm talking about the grammar specifically. English spelling is notoriously tough. But, well, let's just put in a plug for this book. If you ever get some money you don't know what to do with, buy this book, Uncovering the Logic of English. It will open your eyes to the simplicity of the English language in both the spelling and the grammar aspects of it. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 2 has often inspired me. God, speaking to the prophet, said, "Write the vision and make it plain upon tables that he may run that readeth it." The vision is there. It's written. We heard about text for teachers this morning. The books are there. Yes, we need more writers. I'm not saying that. But the texts are there. Can our students understand it? We need to raise a group, a generation of students, of children, of future adults that can understand what they read so that they can run and take the word of God. But you might be saying, you can stand up here and say it simple. It doesn't make sense. Maybe you can identify with this. There are only two rules of English grammar. Rule one. Every rule in the English language has at least one exception. Rule two. If there is no exception, see rule one. I'm not going to try to deny that there aren't exceptions to the rules of English grammar. There are. Embrace those exceptions. That, in my mind, is what makes the language so beautiful. But at the same time, and again, By the way, I'm not a salesman for Logic of English, but I would be if they wanted me to be. She will explain it. She will make it clear in that book that the rules actually make sense. The words follow the rules. The words that look like they don't follow different rules, perhaps. I find the rigid order, the rules, if you choose, of English to be fascinating. And the exceptions, especially when used appropriately in the hands of a good wordsmith, very enlightening. Like this. What's the difference between a cat and a comma? A cat has claws at the end of its paws. A comma is a pause at the end of a clause. Only in English. Try translating that one. It won't go. Now, to be fair here, other languages have their own inside jokes, but you should be able to finish this one. It's a balanced sentence. Some speak because they have to say something. Others speak because they have something to say. Winston Churchill, you'll probably hear a good deal about him this week. He was a master orator, master of the English language. He once said to an opponent in Parliament, "The last thing I want to do is hurt you, but it's still on my list." Here's a rule given by Logic of English. English words do not end in I, J, U, or V. Okay, go ahead. Shoot it down. Give the exceptions.
You.
Right. Okay, what do we do with that? I put a few common exceptions here on the board to help you out. Chai is actually a foreign word. And that's one thing we'll see as we get into this more. English is an inveterate borrower. English is an amalgamation of so many languages, so many words. Just slipped my mind just now which language chai actually came from. I found it fascinating. From Arabic and Russian. So when you enjoy your chai, that's a gift of the Arabs and the Russians. Ski is a Norwegian word. Flu, this one's interesting. Flu, of course, is short for influenza, which comes from Italian, which had the root of being influenced. Influenza, influenced by the stars. You were messed up, astrologically speaking, they thought. So those are not true exceptions to the rules. Those follow other rules. There are three true exceptions. One of them was you, and there are the others. I, you, and thou. Those are true exceptions to that rule. I found that fascinating. The English language provides us with a wide range of words with which to express ourselves. I found differing numbers on how many words there are in the English language, and part of that has to do with the fact that English as an international language has picked up a lot of technological jargon that, you know, if some new element is discovered, they name it. And not every language in the world names it. They'll often name it in Latin, say, for the proper name, and then also in English. But some of the numbers I found were 500,000 to 1,000,000. Another source said 2,000,000 words. And that's just a number, but compare that to French, which is noted for its expressive language, 125,000. So we're looking at 4 to 16 times as many words in our language as the French have. The Germans, 185,000. Typically we use about 40 to 60,000. A well-educated person might know up to 200,000 words, but that's pretty small. So again, a lot of it is technical, but that's a lot of words. One of the beauties of English being a borrowing language is that we have a lot of synonyms. We have a tremendous selection of synonyms that we can choose from. For example, ask, question, interrogate. They mean the same thing, right? Well, pretty much. Ask comes from Anglo-Saxon. Question is from, I'm trying to remember this, I didn't write this down. Better say it right. Yes, question comes from French during the Norman invasion, which we'll talk about in a bit, and interrogate comes directly from Latin. And so we, you know, did I ask you a question? Did I question you or did I interrogate you? There is definitely a difference there. We have those synonyms. Many other languages don't have as many of those. Mark Twain said this: the difference between the right word and almost the right word is the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. Typical Mark Twain style, but he's right. That's the way it is. A few more quotes from Sir Winston Churchill. If I agreed with you, we'd both be wrong. Speaking again of an opponent in Parliament, he was the master of the put-down, by the way. We know that he has, more than any other man, the gift of compressing the largest amount of words into the smallest amount of thought. And he was humble enough to be honest. He said this as well: in the course of my life, I have often had to eat my words, and I must confess that I have always found it a wholesome diet. Do not argue with an idiot. He will drag you down to his level and beat you with experience. Embrace the rules and the exceptions of the English language, because without that, we don't have a basis for communication. You know, in some languages, word order doesn't matter. In English, it does. I have to say, John hit the ball. If I say the ball hit John, that's different. In other languages, that doesn't matter. So, whether we like them or not, we've got them. Grammar's part of our curriculum. We have to teach it. But why was it made a part of our schools? Who decided that we need this in our curriculums? They're on the bottom of the first side of your handout. I have four reasons for teaching grammar, and if you forget everything else I've said, please get this. Why should we teach grammar? First of all, it teaches us to communicate clearly. In the South where I live, we have people called rednecks by people in the other less fortunate parts of the country, whose grasp of vocabulary and grammar perhaps doesn't match the intelligent Westerners or Northerners. But they can communicate expression, gestures, tones, and yet, as much as I love the Southern culture, there is a handicapping element by not being able to communicate clearly. This is, to us as Christian people, especially important because of our responsibility, our mission to take the gospel into all the world. If you can't explain your faith, how can you share it? So we teach grammar because we are teaching the next generation of missionaries. And yes, businessmen, people useful in society, mothers and fathers, but catch a vision for why we teach grammar. It teaches us to communicate clearly. And there is a direct correlation, between understanding grammar well and appreciating quality literature. I've read some of Charles Dickens, and I get lost by him if I read too much at once. But there's a quality to his literature there that is not seen at first glance. And whether or not you enjoy Charles Dickens or read him a lot is beside the point. But the same thing applies to the Word of God. A good, deep, well-founded understanding of the way the English language works can aid our understanding in when we read the Word of God. The power of well-chosen words can move hearts and minds. This is a book I purchased recently, and I just love reading it. Speeches That Changed the World. It has transcripts of all sorts of speeches going all the way back to Queen Elizabeth I. Actually even has Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in here. Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, Douglas MacArthur, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, Pope Francis, Barack Obama, Donald Trump. They're all in here. They're speeches. And it's fascinating to read that, especially the men and women who had a powerful grasp of the English language, the way they could move hearts and minds. I enjoy studying history, especially the era there of the 1930s, when Britain and France were
almost destroyed by the policy of appeasement towards Adolf Hitler. And Churchill was speaking out and writing against this policy and trying to prod his fellow members of parliament into action. The time finally came when he became prime minister. The government of Neville Chamberlain fell because finally people just got entirely frustrated with his conduct of the war. And Winston Churchill became prime minister, but public feeling in England at that time was terribly strong for a negotiated peace with Germany. France was about to collapse. The British were trapped at Dunkirk. And it is thought, actually, that Chamberlain and his sidekick, Lord Halifax, actually set Churchill up to be the next prime minister because he would have to preside over the surrender to Nazi Germany. And, of course, everyone would hate him for that. And then Halifax could be prime minister, which he always wanted to be. It didn't happen. Largely due to Winston Churchill's use of the English language. After one speech of his, it is said, and this is a quote by Edward Murrow, who was a contemporary newscaster, he said, Churchill took the English language, mobilized it, and sent it into battle. And if you read some of his speeches, or better yet, listen to them, the power in them is there. Why? He understood his language. Here's something I found interesting. A speech given in the U.S. Congress after Pearl Harbor. Mr. Speaker, yesterday against the roar of Japanese cannon in Hawaii, our American people heard a trumpet call, a call to unity, a call to courage, a call to determination once and for all to wipe off of the earth this accursed monster of tyranny and slavery which is casting its black shadow over the hearts and homes of every land. We have not been stunned. We have not been terrified or confused. This reassembling of the 77th Congress is proof of that. For the mood of quiet, grim resolution which here prevails bodes ill for those who conspired and collaborated to murder world peace. That mood is stronger than any mere desire for revenge. It expresses the will of the American people to make very certain that the world will never so suffer again. This was Charles Eaton of New Jersey. I don't know the man, but obviously he had a grasp of the language. You can feel the raw emotion, the cadence in his tones. Compare that. And this is perhaps an example of how the English language is degenerating. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that, but we don't have the quality of literature or speech or journalism today as we did even 100 years ago. In 2002, when they were contemplating war on Iraq, a member of Congress says, and if we don't go at Iraq, that our effort in the war on terrorism dwindles down into an intelligence operation. We go at Iraq, and it says to countries that support terrorists, there remain six in the world that are, as our definition states, sponsors of terrorists. You say to those countries, we are serious about terrorism. We're serious about you not supporting terrorism on your own soil. And, you know, it's kind of an American tradition to show a certain skepticism toward our democratic institutions. I myself have sometimes thought the aging process could be delayed if it had to make its way through Congress. But you will deliberate and you will discuss, and that is fine. But, my friends, the people cannot wait. They need help now, and there's a mood among us. People are worried. There has been talk of decline. Now, except for that little side note he throws in there about delaying the aging process by sending it through Congress, that speech is nothing. Look at the text of it sometimes. It's chock full of run-on errors. It's grammatically poor. It's not there. It doesn't move hearts and minds. The second reason for learning English grammar that it helps us learn new languages. Would you agree with that, Faith? Absolutely. Any bit of English grammar you can hang on to when you go to studying a new language, you will use it. And the good thing is, you'll come away from your study of another language with a better understanding of your own language's grammar. So it does work both ways. You know what you call a person who knows two languages? He's bilingual. A person who knows three languages is trilingual. Some of you know where this is going. A person who knows one language is an American. We people need to do better at learning other languages, and I realize this is not about, I think there's actually a class on that here in a day or so, but if nothing else, let's learn our language well. That's a foundation for learning other languages later. Number three, it builds reading comprehension. and I kind of alluded to this before, how much do your third graders understand of the principles of justification as described in the book of Romans? Not very much. How much will an adult who reads at a third grade reading level understand? Will he understand more? Probably not. So, I think that makes its own point.
And the fourth one.
It trains our minds. The brain is a muscle. Refuse to use it, it grows thin and flabby and weak. Use it, and it gets stronger. So you say, I'm not going to... I trust you won't say this as teachers, but your students might say, well, I'm not going to learn a new language. I'm not, you know, I'm just going to help my dad in his blind shop. I don't really like reading anyway. The mental exercise is good for you, and you're going to do it because I said so. You know, sometimes we just have to say that. It is a valuable exercise in training of the brain. And the other thing is, our students are not God. They do not know what they may need their what they may need later in life. Let's take a little rest stop here. Any comments or questions or clarifications you'd like to make to this point before we move on into a look at the history of the English language? Silence is consent to move on. If you have anything at any point, don't be afraid to interrupt me either. I don't mind a bit. It tells me you're paying attention if you interrupt me. English is a changing language. If you look at that second paper I handed out to you, on the one side of it there is an example of the Lord's Prayer at four different points in English history. If you look at the first one there, AD 995 Old English, if I wouldn't tell you that that's the Lord's Prayer, you probably wouldn't know it. It's got some unusual symbols there. For example, there in the second line, that thing that looks like a P and a B put together, that one is called the thorn. There's the ed as well in line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 there, that word that starts with an E. The third letter there is an ed. There's the ash in the line right under that, with that big long word that starts with G-E-D. Someone want to pronounce that one? Those are old letters that have faded out of English at this point. And then if you go across the page to 1389, this is John Wycliffe translated the Bible into English. This is how it appeared in his Bible. You can get that one. That one's starting to make sense, because by this point we're getting into the early stages of Middle English. It's starting to look more familiar. 1526, Tyndale's Bible, we have it again. And then in 1611, the King James Version, and you say, well, that's different than how it shows up in my Bible. Well, yes, because the King James Version has been updated. It's still the same translation, but it has been updated. Notice that the V's are U's. U and V were interchangeable for a long time. It's only been in recent years, recent as in the last 300 to 400, that differentiation has come about. Same thing between I and J. There are a couple other interesting things here. Before I forget it here, you've seen this sort of stuff, especially in, say, places like Colonial Williamsburg or something. It looks like Ye Old Tavern. Well, what that Y is the replacement for the thorn. Because the thorn, I'm getting ahead of myself here, the thorn was the symbol for the sound. And since they didn't, when typesetting came along, it wasn't used very much, so they would often use the Y. So you weren't actually supposed to say that, Ye Old Tavern. It was still the Old Tavern, but it was simply the Y was used in place of it. And that E on the end, silent E in English, has really gone through an evolution. Sometimes it was simply a matter of, this word looks too short, let's put an E on the end of it. Sometimes it was a matter of filling out letters at the end of a line of type for the typist. That probably explains why evil in the 1611 version of the Lord's Prayer there, close to the bottom, has two L's. Probably needed to fill that line of type in. And so spelling, and we're not going to be looking at spelling very much this week at all, but the spelling behind English is fascinating, and some of it has to do with as silly little reasons as that. You know, how do I fill up this line? Just put an E in. Someone has said that the history of English is a history of invasions. And so we have the six invasions here that basically created English as we have it today. Point B here, English is in the Indo-European family tree. If you look at a family tree of languages, say in an encyclopedia or somewhere, it is in the Indo-European family tree. On the Germanic branch, English is actually closely related to the Germanic languages. That's because the foundation for English comes from the Anglo-Saxons, which is a Germanic people group, and we'll look at them in a little bit later. You might be saying, wait a minute, I know enough about Spanish and French to know that English has a lot of common words. Yes, it does. That has to do with multiple periods of history where Latin influenced the developing English language. And of course, Latin is the direct forefather of the Romance languages, Portuguese, Spanish, French, Italian, and Romanian. And those, not all of those languages, especially French, impacted English. Therefore, we have a lot of words that go back to Latin because of that. Up to 50% of our words in the English language today can be traced back to Latin by one means or another, many of them by means of some of these six invasions. The first invasion has been called the Celtic invasion. The Celts, we're not quite sure where they came from, but they replaced the ancient peoples who had lived there. We're talking a long, long time ago here, around the time of Christ, before the Romans came. Rome conquered Britain. And of course, again, just for clarity's sake, we are talking about the development of English in England, because obviously that's where the language developed, came to America because of, well, you know that history. We have very, very little heritage from the Celts, about 10 words, plus maybe a few place names are in the English language today because of the ancient Celts. Now, the Celtic influence isn't dead. It still lives today in the Welsh and the Irish languages, but as far as its impact on English, it's pretty much gone. The second invasion was the Roman invasion when, I believe it was Claudius, conquered it for Rome in, I think, the AD 40s. And during that time, of course, the Romans brought their Latin words into English, and some of those words came into the English language. Again, not terribly much, because we're talking so far back in history. There's been so much other stuff that has happened since then. The Anglo-Saxon invasion was a much more foundational invasion than any of the two before it. When the Anglo-Saxons came, that basically was considered to be the starting point of Old English. So that Lord's Prayer there would fit into this time period. The Old English period from approximately 450 to 1100 AD. There were Germanic peoples. They came across from mainland Europe into England. And that's actually where the word England comes from. Angleland, it was originally, because it was the land of the Angles and the Saxons. The Old English of this point had so many dialects, it was almost not even fair to call it one language. People living as little as 15 miles apart could hardly understand each other. Travel, communication was virtually non-existent, and so the languages kind of developed on their own. There are a lot of interesting words that come to us from this time period. Lord is actually a contraction of two Anglo-Saxon words, the word for loaf and the word for guard. And so a lord was a loaf guard, a bread keeper in charge of the pantry. What in the world? Call a lord of the traditional medieval period a bread keeper and you lose your head, right? Well, that's an example, again, this is probably as good a time as any to mention it. Many words in English have undergone either elevation or degeneration. Obviously, the Lord has undergone a serious amount of elevation from bread keeper to, well, you know what Lord means today. Degeneration. Villain. Would any of you like to be called a villain? That's what my in-laws, future in-laws, called me when I first started coming around because it sounded too close to my name. But originally, a villain was a farm laborer. You work on a farm, you're a villain. Because villa, the root there, is the Latin word for farm. And so there was nothing at all demeaning about that. Call someone a villain today, you have trouble. Here's a good one. If any of you married? Okay. What do you think would happen if you would call your wife a hussy? It wouldn't be good for your relationship. Hussy originally meant housewife. A term of honor. She's a keeper at home. Well, hussy has a very, very negative connotation today. And that's degeneration. All those words, lord, villain, hussy, are words that entered our language during the Anglo-Saxon period, also known as the Old English period. We have a lot of other very common words that come from this time period. Sheep, shepherd, ox, earth, plow, swine, dog, wood, field, work. Just the common earthy type of words. These people were people who lived simply. They worked with their hands. They worked in the earth. The second, or the fourth invasion, was the second introduction to the Latin language. And this was by missionaries. Roman Catholic missionaries, of course. You may have heard the story, Pope Gregory was standing on the docks at an Italian port city as these slaves came, and they were tall and fair-skinned and blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and he said, "Who are these angels?" Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. "Who are these people?" They said, "Well, they are Angles." And he said, "No, they're not Angles, they're angels." And then he said, "Where are they from?" Well, they were from the region of Deira. I'm not exactly sure where that was, but basically in modern England. And he said, "Well, we must send..." And he said, "Are they Christian?" And he said, "No." "Well, these angels should be Christians, and so we're going to send missionaries to save them de ira," Latin, "from wrath." So he wasn't an English speaker, but he had a good grasp of language, and he used it effectively, unless it's just a story, who knows. Anyway, and so he sent the monk Augustine to England to convert the Angles and Saxons, which were pagan at this point. And so because of this, this is also sometimes called the second Latin, or the second introduction of the Latin language. We get a lot of scriptural words from this time period. Angel, devil, disciple, martyr, psalm, bishop, nun, monk, apostle, pope, psalter. And then a lot of common words again as well, like beet, oyster, sock, and so on. Another important contribution during the second Latin influence here was the Roman alphabet was used, which is what we use today. Before that, it was the old runic script. And if your first graders struggle with learning our letters, just be glad you didn't have to teach them the old runic script. That was a mess. In the 800s, a king, King Egbert of Wessex, the western section here of England, came to power, and he worked at unifying much of England under his power. And so his dialect, the Wessex dialect, remember I said Old English had so many dialects, kind of became the standard form of Old English. Well, Old English continued being influenced because of more invasions. The fifth invasion was the Danish Viking invasion. And I say Danish Viking because these Vikings were from Denmark as opposed to Norway or Sweden, where we typically think of Vikings coming from. And the Danes really impacted the English language mostly from the years 750 to 1000. A lot of short, simple words come from the Danes. They, sky, take, cut, are, leg. Sorry, leg is not, was not. an appropriate term for mixed company. A man would not use the term leg around ladies. He would substitute the word limb for it instead. It's more appropriate that way. Another example of, well, what is that, degeneration or elevation? It's less objectionable, so I guess that's elevation. Low root. Anyway, those are some of the words we get from the Danes invading. Danish also gets credit for the elliptical relative pronoun in clauses. For example, we can say the man that I saw was wearing a blue coat, or we can simply say the man I saw was wearing a blue coat. Well, that, if we leave it out, that's an elliptical relative pronoun. We can leave that out because that's how the Danish language was. That came into the English language. The use of the preposition following the phrase to which it applies. You may have heard that, especially by highbrow users of English, it's not proper to end a sentence with a preposition. Well, the Danes brought that in and allowed us to do that. Some people didn't like it. And again, this is a quote attributed to Winston Churchill. It may or may not have been. Winston Churchill is the type of person that he attracts all sorts of quotes. You know, everyone says, well, Winston Churchill said this. This one, I think, is fairly documented, though. He said, this sort of nonsense is something with which I, is something up with which I will not put. Because we would simply say, put up with, well, that's ending with a preposition. You're not allowed to do that. Yes, you are allowed to do that. Thank you for the to the Vikings. Verb phrases actually entered the English language from the Danes as well. A few more characteristics here of Old English. Old English was highly inflected. Nouns were declined for four different cases. If you've ever looked at Latin at all, Latin is also a language with declensions for its nouns. Basically, it means that if you use the noun as a subject, you use it one way. If you use it as an object, you put a different ending on it. And if you use it in the possessive form, you put a different ending on it yet. And we do that sort of with the apostrophe S. That's not exactly a declension, but they had their nouns declined for four different cases. Verbs were inflected much more than today. How many forms does a verb have in the English language? Just five. The present, the past participle, the present participle, and the S form. That's all we've got. There were nine standard endings in Old English, plus who knows how many irregulars, and we still have plenty of irregulars. Just look at the chart there on the wall behind you, and that was there. Adjectives had up to eight forms, depending on, did the noun it modified, was it a masculine noun or a feminine noun? Was it a singular noun or a plural noun? It was a mess. The interest, and then there are all sorts of other different endings for gender, number, person, case, mood, tense, all that stuff that some other languages still have today. You've studied Spanish, you know what a mess Spanish verbs are. It's much more inflected than English. Like I said, English grammar is fairly straightforward when it comes to things like that. And that's because of its long history of aging and changing. It has greatly simplified its grammar. We do have some irregular plurals left from Old English grammar. Child, children, ox, man, woman, foot, goose, tooth, louse, mouse. All those are Old English plurals. Imagine if all our nouns had all those strange ways of making things plural. There were spelling and pronunciation changes from then to now. I've already talked about the extra characters, the thorn, the ash, and the thorn and the ed. The ash was another one. That was basically the A and the E written together like this. We still see it today in a word like Caesar. Why is that Caesar with A-E after? Well, that was because that was the ash and that was the way it was pronounced. Today we don't write it together anymore, but it's still there. We have place names from Old English. Any name of a town that ends in burb or borough or ham or shire or ton, those are Old English place names. There's an interesting story behind the city of Nashville. Nashville was first founded in the late 1700s. By settlers from East Tennessee, and they called it Fort Nashboro. Well, then the Revolutionary War came along, and they didn't care for the English and the British, and they liked the French a whole lot better, so they got rid of the borough ending, which is English, and replaced it with ville, which is a French ending. So we have Nashville. We have not looked at the Norman Conquest yet. I think we may leave that for tomorrow. That is the sixth invasion here, and definitely the most important in terms of what it did to the English language. Thousands of Latin and Greek words entered our language because of the Norman Conquest and the French there, but we'll look at that tomorrow. Any questions that you have? Let's just have a bit of review real quickly then. In what family tree is the English language?
Indo-European.
Which branch of the Indo-European?
Germanic.
And why Germanic? Because of the... Anglo-Saxons. They were Germanic peoples. English has also been influenced heavily by what language?
Latin.
We looked at the first two when the Romans controlled Britain and when the Pope sent missionaries, Catholic missionaries to England. The third one we'll look at tomorrow, which was the Roman conquest. Why teach English grammar? What were the four reasons we had? Teaches us to communicate clearly. Helps us learn new languages.
Builds
reading comprehension. And it trains our mind. Do you have anything to add to that? What are some more good arguments for why we teach English grammar in our schools? The bell hasn't gone yet. Let me read to you an excerpt from Winston Churchill's speech. Winston Churchill never did well with the classical education of that day, learning Latin and Greek. He loved the English language. He especially loved the Anglo-Saxon words, those short, forceful, pointy words. He said this, that even though Europe has fallen under Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. That entire quote there is all Anglo-Saxon words except surrender. And that's the thing he would not do. That was the only word in that quote with a Latin root. I found that fascinating. Thank you for your attendance and attention. You are dismissed.